for this one moment. Know only that you are loved. Know only that you are safe and whole and loved. Know that you belong here, here among us, here on this earth, and in your body, however tired or broken your heart may be. Whatever fear or disappointment or anger you carry, for this hour, know you are not alone. Feel the presence of others surrounding you, breathing, still breathing beside you and with you. Discovering together the way our voices rise and fall together in harmony, in hope, still in hope, claim here a resilient freedom. The choice for love, for light, to live with joy and gratitude and praise as a form of resistance. Already we are organizing. Come, let us worship together. Good morning, friends, and welcome. It is so good to be together this morning.
Freedom. Let's say it together. Freedom.
Freedom.
Freedom. Freedom is essential to Unitarian Universalism. It is elemental to our faith. The most common aspect of freedom that we think about when we think about our shared community is that of our core practice of freedom of belief, right? Which is not to say that here you can believe anything you want to believe. In fact, in our faith, you have the freedom to believe what your heart, what your experience, what the source of truth that flows through you and reveals to you tells you. That's the freedom. You don't have to hide that truth here. You don't have to pretend. You don't have to force yourself to believe that which you know cannot be true. Nor can you take that freedom away from others. Because human beings were made to be free. Free to choose. Free to be. Free to love. This freedom we hold as sacred, as holy, as essential. Not only because it does nobody any good for you to have to parrot beliefs or values that fail to resonate in your core. Not only because we have seen the devastating implications of societies and groups who have tried to enforce a uniformity of belief. Not only because the revelation of truth through each of us enriches our collective understanding. Not only for those reasons. But here's the second and equally important aspect of freedom in our tradition. We are endowed with freedom, and thus all of us, each of you, are responsible for our actions together in this life. That is what freedom means. That is what freedom entails. We hold freedom as sacred, as holy, as essential, because we believe what you do matters. What we do matters. There is no coercion here. No God that will smite you for not following the rules. Each of us, all of us, are free to influence the world, constrained by realities for sure, but not preordained, not predestined. We don't know what is going to happen. Each of us, every day, has the choice to bless, to heal, or to harm. To choose the myth of independence or the truth of our interconnection. To shun the lure of love that is drawing us forth to its transformative ways. to say no to that, to turn away. We can decide it is too hard, that it costs too much. But with freedom, there is no guarantee it will work out. Freedom means that the only hands that will reach across the aisle are yours. Freedom means that the only heart that can break open to another story is yours. Freedom means that the only feet that can walk the marathon race towards justice are yours and mine. That is why freedom is sacred, because it doesn't let us off the hook, because it binds us together in the common enterprise of creation, of discerning and answering that call of love. Years ago, this symbol, this flaming chalice, was created by an Austrian refugee who had fled Nazi Germany. During the war, this symbol came to adorn thousands of documents that were used to bring refugees out of occupied Europe. It was a symbol of freedom, of safety. Today we light our chalice, binding our call for religious freedom that has echoed through the ages with the true gravity of our choices that we are offered each and every day. May together we always set our minds to freedom. Every week, our Unitarian Universalist Association, the collective being of our congregation, sends out an email with a hopeful word every Wednesday. Jake Morrill was tasked to give that good word on Wednesday. And after he saw the results of the election, he had to change what he wrote. So I'm going to share with you the updated, braver, wiser reading that our colleague, the Reverend Jake Morrill from Knoxville, Tennessee, wrote in the aftermath. On Monday, everything near Knoxville was on fire, or it seemed like it. A dry yellow fog had settled into the valley, carrying a bitter scent. Tennessee State Forestry officials reported 20 wildfires, most of them started by arson. On election day, the fires went on. One burned down 100-acre wood. Who would have gone and done something like that? What made them go out and lash out and want to burn it all down? A friend said maybe arson wasn't the only reason for all the harm done. Maybe some of it was carelessness. This morning, where I live, the smoke has cleared away, but in our nation, a bitter fog has settled in, making it hard to breathe and hard to see. Countless of us greet the day, still in something like shock, wondering what led so many in our democracy to want to go out and lash out and burn it all down. Wondering how many lives are at risk, and how on earth we will live. In the book of Esther, in the Hebrew scriptures, Esther finds herself at a similar pivotal moment. King Xerxes, ruler of the Persian Empire, is reckless, extravagant, and not all that bright, endangering all those who live under his erratic rule. In his dull vanity, Xerxes sentences all the Jews in the kingdom to death. At this moment in peril, Esther's cousin, Mordecai, appeals to her to help because Esther, who is herself Jewish, enjoys a place of privilege in the empire. She is reluctant to risk it. But Mordecai tells her it is not certain in the coming wrath that her privilege would save her. Help, he conceded, might possibly come from somewhere else. But he concluded, who's to say whether you've come to this place and position for a time like this? Who's to say? This morning we awake to a democracy set recklessly, carelessly ablaze, and the fire has only now started to spread. It reaches far beyond federal policy or the Supreme Court. It reaches elementary school classrooms where there is now further license to bully. My wife has started to call the migrant family she works with, whose neighbors have chanted at them, "Build the wall." Those of us with some privilege in this empire may be tempted to seek refuge in it, as if privilege would ever save us. But who's to say whether you have come into this place and position for a time such as this? Upon hearing this question, though, Esther doesn't leap into action, doesn't issue a statement, doesn't post a quip on Facebook. She knows what is asked of her is nothing less than to risk her safety, her life. So she asks her people to fast and pray with her. She takes time to prepare herself for what life now requires of her. That is what time it is for us today, all together. It is time to reflect, time to be still, time to feel all of the feelings. And to prepare ourselves. Who's to say whether, in fact, we were made for a time such as this?
I know you were all reading your program and wondering if perhaps I was going to sing the sermon. I'm sorry to disappoint. But that would be interesting, wouldn't it? As part of our monthly theme this Sunday, we were supposed to explore the question, when in your life have you experienced a plot twist? Seriously, back in September when we decided on these weekly questions, we were like, plot twist, that'll be interesting. But then this past Tuesday night, I realized that plot twists are only interesting in retrospect. Because the middle of the plot twist, it isn't interesting, it's traumatic. It was around 10:30 on Tuesday night when the trauma started to hit. Like millions of people all across the country, our staff team was texting each other in earnest, "What is happening?" Now, up until that point, I thought we had been preparing for any outcome. Regardless of how the election went, the message for Sunday and in all our work together would be generally the same. In the midst of our divided country, our faith's good news of the inherent worth of all and our ultimate interconnectedness, that faith that we need not think alike to love alike, offers us the tools and the responsibility to connect across differences, heal the divisions in our country and in our hearts, and weave a new shared story together. No matter the results, I'd thought, this would be the message. Over the course of the night, however, I realized I'd been fooling myself. It started around 7:30, maybe 8. I was in a meeting when my partner, Carrie, she started to text me. Our daughter had been watching the election returns with a friend. She's 11. And she'd come home sobbing, sure that she and or her friends would be sent to Mexico. My daughter, Graciela, she's Hispanic. Her birth father was Mexican, but she was born in Denver. We are her legal parents, both of us. She's been with us since she was 3 days old. But it's confusing. I mean, kids don't get it. Turns out grown-ups don't always get it either. So while we've reassured her that no one can take her from us, there is still an underlying sense of risk that we can't entirely reassure in her, or truthfully, in us. When I got that text from Carrie, a lump started to form in my throat. And all night, as the return started to come in, it just grew bigger and bigger as I imagined all the Hispanic kids across the country. All the Muslim children, the trans youth, the women who have experienced sexual assault, which, by the way, is 1 in 5. And all the people working so hard for our planet and our planet. This lump just grew and grew as I felt so many people across our country, like my daughter, just scared and hurting, and all of them sobbing. This lump in my throat, it told me all of our plans were wrong. I mean, they were good, they're still true, but they'd been plans for a different world, a different story than what was emerging. They were assuming a world of greater safety, greater predictability, and a level of continuity, and a world that could no longer be counted on. We needed a new plan for Sunday, and likely for everything. Our nation woke up Wednesday morning into a new world. The transition from sleep to waking, I admit, has always been hard for me. I'm usually disoriented, bleary-eyed, angry, a little irrational. I'm not a very good mom or partner when I'm trying to wake up. It's a slow process. I just resist the idea that sleeping is over. Grieve the loss of my cozy quiet. Fight the requirement to do something new, like move, or talk, or see things with my eyes open. This is exactly how I've been feeling since Tuesday night. Disoriented, angry, grief-stricken, resistant. I managed to get the letter out to all of you about the election results and invite the Vespers service, thank you for coming, Wednesday night. But immediately after that, at midnight, I sat there sobbing the way my daughter, I imagined, had been sobbing a few hours before. And the lump in my throat, it was still there. It's still there. We woke Wednesday morning to a new world. But it wasn't like the world wasn't there before. So many of our lives have been so much more at risk than most of us have been paying attention to. Black lives, immigrant lives, queer lives, the lives of the poor, the chronically ill, children's lives. All of our lives are so fragile, and so many of our social systems are inadequate or broken. And racism and sexism and homophobia, xenophobia, these are real and systemic and generational. And we knew this before, but also we try not to think about it. Especially those of us who don't have to think about it. We take for granted a certain inevitability of moral progress, right? We assume that as time moves forward, so will the reach of justice, that it must be that as each day passes, the world will become more inclusive, more compassionate, more loving. I mean, this is the story that exists deep in our consciousness. We assume that progress of any sort means progress of all sorts. As Unitarian minister Theodore Parker's quote that both Martin Luther King Jr. and President Obama have referenced, the moral arc of the universe, surely it bends towards justice. This week, we awoke to the reality that our Native American siblings have been living with for centuries. That is, there is no inevitability to the march of justice. Sometimes, the moral arc bends away from justice, just as suddenly as it seemed that it had bent towards it. And sometimes that new day brings not greater clarity or goodness, but chaos and fear and loss. It can be so terrible waking up. Since Tuesday, I think many of us have been bleary-eyed and grieving, just wanting to pull the covers back over our heads. We've started rationalizing or blaming, turning the whole thing, some of us, into an intellectual exercise, like, why did the polling go so wrong? Maybe the third party voters are to blame, or our two-party system, or the electoral college, or the media. Or we bargain, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe he didn't mean all those things he said. Or even, maybe now we will have real change. Maybe this will turn out to be a good thing. Burn it all down. We are each coping in different ways to this global plot twist, this trauma, depending on how personally we feel the potential impact, how vulnerable we or our children are. The story that we thought we were living in about how the world should or does work, maybe most of all, how committed we are to the cozy quiet and the not seeing things with our eyes open. Before Tuesday, my coping strategy had been what I called the long view. I'd been channeling my teacher, Dr. Vincent Harding. You know, I quoted him a few weeks ago. He's the one who said that America was in the process of birthing a new story. And it was our jobs to be midwives for that new day. Since waking up on Wednesday, I've needed something more than the long view. It's what I'm calling the longer view. Because my dear Dr. Harding died last year, meaning that he did live to see the first African-American president, when he called him Brother Barack. But he did not have to see his brother hand over the presidency to a man endorsed by the KKK. So instead of Dr. Harding, I've needed to think about those people who lived in crazy times, terrible times, and who died with the world still terrible. But they were part of the love and the resistance their whole lives. People like Susan B. Anthony, who died before the women got the vote. Or Sojourner Truth, who I've been reading her. Whew, go read her. She died after the Civil War, so she did see that, but she was working for something much bigger, a greater liberation for African Americans and women that she did not see in her lifetime. Or Oscar Wilde, Gertrude Stein, or 1,000 other gay men and women and trans and gender nonconforming people who've loved and survived and claimed their truth, even at the risk of imprisonment or death, who kept loving. As Teresa Hardy wrote this week, I got out of bed this morning because of all those who had to get out of bed before me. Martin and Coretta the day after his home was bombed. What did they tell the children? My ancestors, who were dragged to the U.S. in chains, laid flat like chattel on ships, and survived. They survived and got out of bed each morning. I am sick and tired and grieving and ready to quit this country, but I got out of bed, shamed by the thought of letting these ancestors down. And for now, that's how I'm getting through the day. One of the ancestors I've been drawing on these past few days has been Theodore Parker, he of that troublesome quote on the arc of the moral universe. Parker's life was actually, it turns out, filled with plot twists, often traumatic and heartbreaking. 7 of his siblings and both of his parents died of tuberculosis before he'd even entered the ministry. It was his grief that inspired his search to understand and experience an unadorned and true God. This relentless search led him to reject traditional notions of religion, as well as traditional thinking when it came to slavery. His faith in a loving, freedom-insisting God required abolition and resistance to the Fugitive Slave Act, as well as numerous other social and political reforms. Now, we Unitarians today, we consider ourselves to be quite progressive, but at the time, while many of us were anti-slavery, we were not abolitionists, because we supported a more gradual transformation. See, we couldn't risk the cotton money that flowed through our churches. And besides, it was the law. All of this meant that Parker was scorned and excluded by his fellow Unitarian ministers, even while his bold claims for a loving God and a deeper justice created a huge and committed following in his church. He saw 2,000 people sometimes on a Sunday, which for his time had to be considered a mega church. I call him the first UU mega church preacher. Still, I imagine that Parker was often lonely, and on many days wasn't sure if at all his sacrifice was really making a difference. And Parker died. He died in 1860, which is a year before the outbreak of the Civil War and 3 years before the Emancipation Proclamation. And so it's from this context that I've realized we need to hear his famous quote, which I'll share now in full. Now think of his whole story. He says, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one, and my eye reaches but a little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice." Martin Luther King, he was known for his refrain, maybe you know it, "How long? Not long." But this week I've been thinking, how long? Long. Maybe very long. And considering the story of his life, I think Parker knew this, and so did Martin Luther King, of course. Our eyes and our lives reach but a little ways, and the moral arc is long, long, and often longer. We can't complete the figure by experience of sight, only by conscience. In this moment, and maybe in a number of moments to come, we may not be able to see the good, the just, but we can feel its righteousness. Feel what is right in our hearts, our guts, and by our faith. By our faith, we know that in the longer arc, there is more love somewhere, and we shall overcome. Now, over these last 4 years with you, I have tried to draw a line between liberal religion and liberal politics. I have urged us to remember that our mission is the former rather than the latter. And despite what you may have taken from all that I've said this morning, I remain committed to this distinction, because it is our faith that has something to say about that lump in my throat. maybe in all our throats. No matter how we voted or how we feel about the results, it is our faith that calls us to see the tears of our children, our Hispanic children, our Black children, our disabled children, our Jewish children, our children who are different in all sorts of ways, who are homeless or hungry, who were already too vulnerable. It asks us to take seriously the potential appointment of Sheriff Joe Arpaio that was floated this week, that terrorizing sheriff who was finally ousted from Arizona, who's now being considered as the head of Homeland Security. It asks us not to turn away from things like this as they roll out, but to keep waking up each day again and more. And I know if you're like me, you may be wondering if you're up for this, if we're up for such a task, and how. But also, have you heard the reports, the stories being shared, the chants of build that wall, the calls to make America white again? They say, each in these reports, they keep saying that hate has been unleashed. I keep hearing people use that word that incredibly we carefully and boldly declared was our word just a couple weeks ago, that we would unleash love. And so I can't help thinking it is possible that we were made for a time such as this. Now, like Queen Esther, we need not act hastily, but only deliberately. As we have this morning, we need to gather together first, and then again and again over time in prayer and song, in tenderness and in community. Because while we feel the fierce urgency of now, we cannot calculate the curve of this moral arc. It could be a long, long road ahead. So we need a regular practice that tends to beauty, cultivates wonder, awe, and gratitude, allows us to renew and to sort out all we're seeing and feeling along the way. Which is to say, these are the days when we need to keep coming to church. I know I'm biased, but I swear it's true. These are the days when we need to keep coming to church and we need to invite our friends. I know we can be shy about our faith, but this too needs a new plan. Too many are grieving and struggling, and they could use community, and we could use them. Bring them all. Bring yourselves in more fully and more often, because we need each other. We're going to need each other. And the world needs us to coordinate and work together. Inviting our friends to church is the easy part, of course. The harder part is putting into practice the courageous love. What will be asked of us? What risks of comfort or stability or safety will our faithfulness require? We're just starting to learn. From early reports, it seems the schools are the place to start. K-12, but also CSU, Front Range. Surely our ministry with and for families and children and youth and immigrants we'll also need a new plan. But even this is not clear. For this morning, we offer you two small yet meaningful ways to unleash love in the coming days. The first, we offer you to wear a safety pin as a sign of solidarity with potentially targeted groups. It's an idea that originated after the Brexit, when the UK saw a 57% increase in anti-immigrant attacks. So people wore a safety pin to signal that they were safe. So you'll find them. They're on tables back there. If we don't have enough, you know where to find them. Go and find them. Hand them out to your friends. And as you do, make a commitment to speak up, to shield, to risk your comfort on behalf of another. The second practice is being called neighborhood love notes. It's a practice of sidewalk chalk. You'll find also in the back, there's some chalk back there. We invite you to go out in the coming days and write messages of love and solidarity wherever you think they may be needed. When you write a love note, we'd ask also you'd snap a picture of it and post it to our Facebook page with the hashtag #UnleashLove, or send it to us and we'll do that on your behalf. So we can see all the notes, all the unleashing that we're all doing. After any trauma, the healing process begins with baby steps, little ways of beginning to move forward. It can be hard because some of us want to leap forward with giant leaps. And the time for giant leaps, it will come. But we don't know enough yet. And I know this makes our fear potentially more debilitating rather than motivating. So I offer you these words from activist and writer Rebecca Solnit, who reminds us that the future is dark, but it is a darkness as much of the womb as of the grave. Steady yourselves, friends, and lean in closer. The great labor is just beginning. I love you. Amen. Blessed be. As we close, I offer these words from Olympia Brown, Universalist minister, suffragette, who did live to see women get the vote. She says, "Stand by this faith, work for it, and sacrifice it. There is nothing in all the world so important as to be loyal to this faith which has placed before us our loftiest ideals, which has comforted us in sorrow, strengthened us for noble duty, and made the world beautiful. Do not demand immediate results, but rejoice that we are worthy to be entrusted with this great message, that you are strong enough to work for a great, true principle without counting the cost. Go on finding ever new applications of these truths and new enjoyments, and always trusting in the one God which ever lives and loves. Our worship time has ended. May our service begin. Go in peace and in love. Amen."